This is the In Focus podcast from The Hindu.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the In Focus podcast. I'm your host, Jee Sampath. Housing is a basic requirement for dignity of life, but affordable, decent housing remains a distant dream for the majority of Indians, especially in urban India. Close to 17% of all households in urban India live in slums, with this percentage shooting up to 41% in a city like Mumbai and 29% in Chennai. Over the years, the Government of India has taken many initiatives to address this problem, with schemes such as the Indira Awas Yojana and the ongoing Pradhan Mantri Awas Yojana, or PMAY as it's known, an interest subsidy scheme for lower and middle income groups. But these subsidy schemes hardly seem to make a dent on the housing crisis. The gap between people's incomes on the one hand and the price points of housing stock on the other, especially for the aspirational classes, remains wide. So why is housing in India so expensive? Why do the prices never seem to come down? A recent research paper titled House Prices in India, How High and How Long, co-authored by three analysts from the Center for Social and Economic Progress, Shishir Gupta, Nandini Agnihotri and Annie George, offers some insightful answers to these questions. And to discuss this subject in detail, we have with us one of the authors of this paper, Shishir Gupta, who is Senior Fellow and COO at the Center for Social and Economic Progress, New Delhi. Shishir, welcome to In Focus and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sampath, for inviting me. Pleasure to be discussing this important topic.
Great. So Shishir, to start with, in your paper, you talk about what you call price to income ratios, PTI as it's called, and use this metric to assess affordability of housing in our country. So can you talk a little bit about where does India fall in the affordability map when compared to other countries, you know, in this price to income ratio thing? And how useful is it to even put out, to sort of even out the variation in PTI in different geographies or cities of India to arrive at a national figure, as you've done in your paper? Because we know that, for example, housing in Delhi, you know, the prices are very different, affordability is different from, say, in Bombay or Kanpur.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Let me first, for your audience's benefit, explain what does PTI really mean, right? So PTI stands for price to income ratio, and it is usually regarded a good affordability metrics. What it captures is what is the price of buying a 90 square meter apartment by a household which earns
90 square meter would be like how many square feet? Because we generally in India, we use square feet.
Around 950 to 1,000. Okay. So that is the standard size that is taken. And so that is the size of the unit. And affordability benchmark, which is considered to be affordable by a majority of population, is if a household whose income is the median income of the country, right, can afford to buy a 90 square meter apartment. Okay. So this is the definition that is also used by the Parekh Committee of 2008. And that is usually regarded as the affordability benchmark in India, that if the housing price is between 4 to 5 of PTI, then housing is considered affordable. Now, our paper finds that the PTI for India, in our case, urban India, is around 11. So around two times more than the affordability benchmark.
So a PTI of 11 would mean that the price of a house is 11 times their annual income. Is that how it is?
Price is 11 times price of a 90 square meter apartment for an average household is 11 years of their income, as opposed to 5 years, which it should be.
Okay.
And this has been, the PTI hovers in this range of 10 to 11 for the last decade or so, for which the data is available. Okay. So relative to the affordability benchmark, India's housing is expensive. And now, as you look around the world, right, something interesting comes out. Because when we started the paper, to be honest, we thought India would be amongst the most expensive housing markets in the world, right? But surprisingly, that is not the case, right? In the developed world, for example, if you look at US, right, you would be surprised, at least I was surprised, that the PTI is 3.6. And for example, in Germany, it is 9, right, which is significantly lower than 11. In the developing world, though, right, PTI is, for some of the countries that we looked, is actually significantly worse than India. So, for example, it is 26 for Sri Lanka and 29 for China. So the first important thing is that PTI is at 11 is significantly higher than the affordability benchmark of 5. Having said that, when we look around the world, we are not one of the most expensive housing markets at a national level, because there are developing countries like Sri Lanka and China, which have a significantly higher PTI. It, to your question, right, what could be the variation across cities, right, around this average of 11? I think that is a great question, because we know, for example, that Mumbai has a PTI of close to 40, okay, and that shows up in roughly half of Bombay's population living in slums, right? Because at 40, pretty much the average household cannot afford to buy a house in Mumbai. Having said that, Mumbai, according to our database, is truly an outlier with a PTI of close to 40. For majority of big Indian cities, again, for which the data is available, PTI is between 10 to 15. And for a few, it is sub 10, but not, I don't think we saw any Indian city which has a PTI of close to 5, right? So basically, to your question of variation across cities, there does exist variation. But does it imply that PTI of 11 is relevant for one types of cities and not to the other types? I don't think that is the answer, because on an average, PTI is higher, significantly higher than the affordability benchmark of 5 for majority of big Indian cities.
And this would apply even to tier 2 and tier 3 cities?
This PTI or affordability benchmark, these are not available for a large number of cities. We could find this for 23 Indian cities. Now, some of them, like I think Kanpur could, or Vadodara, right, could be considered as tier 3. The cities like Kochi, Ahmedabad are in tier 2. But this is the average, to be honest, is biased towards large Indian cities. Having said that, I think a predominant proportion of urban India also lives in large Indian cities, right? So to that extent, whether this average is representative of a challenge that urban Indians face, I think this is a workable number.
Right. Thank you for that, Shishir, for laying out the big picture in terms of urban housing affordability. Appreciate that. Now, moving on to the other side of the story here, can you give us a historical overview of what have we really done so far? What has the government done? We know that housing is very important. Affordability is a problem. So what has been done so far to ensure decent housing for the bulk of the people, you know, the poor and the middle classes?
To be honest, we have not gone back too much in history, right, when we did the paper, because our main focus was on understanding why prices are high and are they likely to stay at this level. So I'll focus my answer on a couple of most ambitious affordable housing schemes that the government has implemented over the last couple of decades. To just give a flavor to the audience, on what has been the thrust and how is government thinking of creating on solving this challenge for the needy. The first scheme that I want to talk about is the Indira Awas Yojana, which ran from 1985 till 2012. And this is basically to provide subsidized and, if I remember correctly, free housing, right, to the rural poor. So it was all, it's essentially giving either a house or building a house or an extension of the house in rural areas, all by the government. It did not require any payment from the beneficiaries, right? pretty successful, I think, because estimates suggest that this scheme resulted in constructing close to 24 million houses during this time period, which is roughly 10% of the total rural housing stock. So from the breadth of the scheme, it was a big scheme, right, covering 10% of the rural population of the country. The more recent example is that of an urban scheme, which we'll know as Pradhan Mantri Awas Yojana, right, which is, I think, in the 10th year of its running. And it has four components. And interestingly, the components that are focused on providing an extension of the existing house to people in the lower middle income, to lower income groups, or helping improve their affordability if they decide to buy a house, that has driven 80% of the number of sanctions under this scheme, right? So the point here is that whether we take the Indira Awas Yojana, which provided essentially free housing or extensions of housing to rural population, or to the Pradhan Mantri Awas Yojana, which has four components, and 80% of the action has happened through sub-schemes which give money to the people to either build their houses or extend their houses, right?
What are the other two components which didn't really attract so much of interest?
The one key element, one sub-component of the scheme is affordable housing for the poor, where the developer is incentivized a subsidy amount by the state if they launch and create affordable housing. That did not see much traction. And I think the fourth component is in-situ slum redevelopment, right? Which is essentially converting slums into decent housing. That also did not see much of attraction. It is these two components which essentially give money to the people. And essentially, these are people who already have a house in the city. Okay, so it is money to them to extend their existing house, reconstruct it. But the main criterion is they need to have ownership of the land, right, to be able to avail of this scheme. And of course, they need to fall in the lower income and economically weaker section of the population.
Right. Interesting how both these schemes, even as you also pointed out in your paper, they sort of aim to help with managing, giving access to housing without really getting into the bigger picture of, supply of land and, affordability and so on. So I was just wondering if you can expand on those aspects, the reasons why housing is expensive in India. When your paper says there are structural reasons, and it's not some kind of an unreasonable price boom, as you already pointed out, that India's prices are not that high compared to other developing countries and so on. So what do you mean exactly by structural reasons? Are they to do with land supply, or are they to do with other things?
So again, when we started the paper a couple of years back, Sambar, we had couple of hypotheses, right? One is housing is very expensive in India, probably one of the most expensive, which, as we discussed, did not turn out to be the case. And the second was that the housing is expensive, we believe, because of runaway increasing house prices over the last 2-3 decades. Okay, so these were the two sort of questions we had. Now, surprisingly, the second one also did not turn out to be the case, right? So housing overall, or house prices over the last 30 years have risen on an average at an annual rate of 9.3%, compared to 9.2% increase on an annual basis for gold and 13.5% for stocks. So by this yardstick, and these are the three main three main sources of storing wealth. So as you can see, right, I mean, housing is an attractive investment, but it is not, it did not outperform the other stores of wealth by a significant margin. In fact, it is significantly lower than what people on an average may have earned investing in stocks over a long period, right? I mean, 30 years is not a short duration. So our second hypothesis that housing is expensive because of runaway increase in prices also fell through the cracks. And when we looked around whether this pattern of return is consistent or are we unique, literature suggests that in most of the countries, housing does not give the best return. It is typically the second or third return yielding asset class after stocks. So again, I think so that was a big learning for us. Now, having settled the issue that the housing is expensive, but it is not because of some runaway increase in prices, we then moved to the key question, right? Then why is housing expensive? Why do we have a PTI of 11 and not closer to 5, which is the affordability benchmark, right? And that led us to the fundamental answer, which is that housing is expensive because of constrained and unpredictable supply of land. And this stems from a lack of credible and rigorous land use planning and implementation. Just to build on this, only 28% of Indian cities have an approved master plan. And almost none of them are detailed enough or have requisite financing to make sure that the city develops according to the plan, right?
Right, Shishir, can you talk a little bit about why do you need a master plan at all in the first place? I mean, why can't you just let people, build houses and, and demand supply and the market will take care of it? What is the importance of a master plan in this context?
You see, what does master plan do, right? Master plan essentially tells you, okay, this is the city of, let's say, Delhi, and these areas are designated for construction of residential houses. These are for commercial, these are for schools, amenities, roads, etc. Right? I mean, because unless you have a master plan, imagine if you don't have a master plan and if you let people, then how do I know, either as an individual or a developer, that where can I build my house, right? Or where can I develop a housing project, or where, what areas are designated for building office complexes? So a master plan, the first and the basic thing it does is give clarity. What can happen where from a spatial perspective, right? Now, the second aspect is, it as I briefly mentioned, it also captures key amenities that are to be developed because you need amenities, right? So, civic amenities for offices to come up by private developers and for housing projects and individual houses. Like, for example, laying of sewage pipes, building of arterial roads, metros, etc., right?
So how exactly does this master plan, as you explained so well, which lays out the spatial, locations of each of these amenities, having it or not having it, how does it affect house prices?
So having it is a necessity because without having it, if you don't have a master plan, which means there is this open land, and then how do you decide what thing comes up where? Right. So that the state has to tell, right, that these areas are earmarked for this purpose. But what is important, right, is that so that is the first step, right? The second is having a master plan. First of all, that itself is available only for 28% of Indian cities. The rest are developing, I don't know on actually what basis, right? But even for those, the big cities, most of the big cities have master plans. But you see, master plan, as the word indicates, is a plan, right? And unless there is financing teeth to the master plan, it cannot be taken very seriously, right? Because if I am a developer, let's say, and I am interested in one area of, let's say, a city where I want to develop a housing project or a commercial project or an office project. And the master plan says that this is a good location because there is a proposed metro line in the vicinity of that area. Now, my plan the success of my plan depends critically on when this metro line will come up in that area, right? And hence, and the metro line cannot come unless you have financing for it. And most of Indian cities' master plans do not give a concrete idea of by when will X, Y, Z things that are major things proposed in the master plans come to reality. And one of the key reasons why they don't give to our understanding why you lack this granularity is because the master plan is not associated with funding that is required, because you can't develop these big infra projects unless you have requisite funding. And this is in stark contrast to, for example, Singapore, which is very, very granular. You have actually plot by plot plans of what can come up where. And also, if there are big infra projects like a metro that they are proposing or an extension of metro, it actually gives, according to my memory, almost an annual or once every 2 year milestones, right, of how the metro is metro line is expected to develop over time. So it's proving to be a longish answer, but I think it's an important question. So let me step back, right? Master plan is a must because it gives you clarity on what areas are earmarked for what. But having a master plan is not good enough unless the city develops according to the plan. And the city cannot develop according to the plan unless you have requisite funding earmarked for the big infra amenities that are proposed in the plan. That is sorely lacking in Indian cities, right? As a result, what happens is that it becomes very unpredictable for developers as to which area of the city will see infra build-up, because it is not laid out in the plan, right? And even if it is, because there is no explicit funding tied to it, the credibility of such a claim may not be very high. And because of this unpredictability, right? So supply is low because supply of land is low, right? Because FSI that in India are low, which is how much can you build per square meter of land. And on top of it, you have this unpredictability, right, as to which part of the city will now see infra development. And because of these two reasons, right, these two structural reasons, land becomes a scarce resource, an unpredictable resource, which pushes up the housing prices.
Right. Thank you for that explanation. I mean, it's an in-depth explanation. Thank you for that, Shishir. I appreciate that. You know, both these points, you know, the master plan either not being there, or when they are there, there is no financial teeth to whatever it claims to be sort of planning for. And secondly, you know, the whole unpredictability attached to this. I mean, both these things are not really great for creating affordable housing. Well, that is of course clear. But I was just wondering, like, there may be one more link in this chain which we need to sort of touch upon, perhaps, which is like, what is it about this unpredictability that leads to, you know, housing prices going up? Is it that there is some kind of insider trading which goes on because, you know, there is this nexus between developers and political connections, their political connections? So this unpredictable land supply could you know, potentially lead to some kind of an insider information where there is speculative purchase of land and then and sale and resale of it with prices going up. And then when the developer comes to it, the land prices, you know, in the context of scarcity are already high. And if you're building a house on top of a high priced land, it's going to be high. Is that what happens, or am I reading a little too much here?
That seems like a possible inference, but we don't have evidence, at least we don't have evidence to prove this linkage. Okay. Having said that, what this unpredictability and scarce supply of land does, right, is that it incentivizes the developers who all own parcels of land to keep them in check, right? Because they know that there is unpredictability and supply of land is not coming as much as the demand. So if I am a developer, and if I behave rationally, I would hold on to my supply of land, especially the good parcels of land, right, to make maximum profits, right, by developing housing or commercial or office projects on it, because I know that what I have in terms of land supply is limited. And as a result, our paper shows that real estate industry is not as competitive as some of the other industries are, like auto, FMCG, or even IT. So there are a number of developers in real estate which over the last 25 years that we've analyzed have earned more than 20% profit after tax, which is very high. Right. So it does result, right? Unpredictable and restricted supply of land does result in less than competitive real estate industry, enabling them to charge a higher price for their products. But that to my mind is a rational behavior, right? I mean, the fundamental reason is a constrained and unpredictable land supply because of lack of master planning and not having requisite financing to make it happen.
Right. In allied to this unpredictable land supply, Shishir, one observation in your paper is the link between transparency in the real estate sector and affordability. I mean, India is classified as semi-transparent, which means we are not really transparent in terms of, you know, the whole sector itself. So what exactly are the points of opacity, and what policy measures should or could the government take to increase transparency in the real estate sector so that it feeds into a more affordable kind of a space for consumers?
Yeah. So in the spirit of full disclaimer, we used JLL's index of transparency in the real estate sector, which they do for, I think, around 40-50 countries across the world. And they classify India as semi-transparent, their index, right? Now when we dug deeper into their index, the index comprises of, I think, six pillars. What is interesting is that we fare the worst in the pillar which is called regulatory and compliance. And when we dug further into what all goes in this pillar, regulatory and compliance, it comprises of things like existence of land use rules and zoning, predictability of changes in land use and zoning, right? So essentially things which are to do with, do you have a master plan, and how granular it is, and how predictable it is, right? So what we found out at the higher end, and what people keep talking about, right, the need for a master plan, actually reflected pretty neatly in terms of us faring at the worst level in this pillar of JLL's transparency index, according to which we are in semi-transparent category. If we have to correct for this, right, which is if we have to correct for or if we have to move from semi-transparent to transparent category, then I think few things need to happen, right? I mean, which is government has taken a welcome step of ushering in RERA, Real Estate Regulation Act, right? Which I think has some very good provisions, right, in terms of opening an escrow account where developers need to keep the buyer's money so that it cannot be diverted to any other project, and also mandating them to disclose details on the project, basic things like what is the area, carpet area, etc. Right. So we need to strengthen that. And one other thing that we need to do is digitization of land records, in addition to improving our master planning, right? Because land records in India are in not in a good shape. And if we can digitize, then at least one can easily find out who does this land belong to. And this actually will help in planning for the cities as well, right? Because unless you know who this land belongs to, it becomes very difficult to plan.
Right. Digitization of land records is, of course, something which would help in transparency. And from what I understand, regulatory issues and compliance. which means rules being followed and predictability of rules being followed is an issue in the real estate sector. And I think it also ties in with the other point you had made earlier about the real estate sector not being that competitive enough. And moving on, Shishir, the one other dimension which your paper sort of touches upon is the entire shadow economy, quote unquote, which sort of queers the pitch for affordable housing. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of shadow economy we are talking about here? Is it to do with speculation over land prices, or is it about black money coming into the sector and pushing up? Is it like the investment demand over sort of overshadowing the use value demand, users demand for housing? Like what exactly you mean here?
Yeah. So shadow economy is in our scheme of things refers to the black income or black economy part of it, right? Essentially income that is unaccounted for. According to one paper that we referred to for 2017, India had around, I think, 18 or 20% of shadow economy, right? Which is that much is the unaccounted income in the country. Now, as you can imagine, right, if one has unaccounted income, then that person would need to store it somewhere, right? Park it somewhere. Part of it is used in consumption, but a large part of income is savings, right? So how do you save unaccounted income, which is represented by shadow economy? There are, again, as we discussed, three typical sources. Either you invest in stocks, gold, or real estate. Now, real estate gives a good avenue for parking unaccounted income because of the following reasons, right? I mean, you can invest, you can park a lot of income in real estate. It cannot be stolen, right? Because it's physical. And probably most importantly, because of the semi-transparent nature of the industry, it is easier for people to park their unaccounted income in real estate. So what happens is, so far we were discussing the supply side constraints, right? In terms of not having enough land, unpredictability of land supply, etc., pushing up the prices. Shadow economy makes the problem sharper, because with shadow economy, your demand gets inflated, as a result reinforcing the high house price structure in the country. We find reasonably strong positive relationship between the PTI, price to income ratio, and the share of shadow economy, and the correlation is around 0.6, which is pretty high, actually. I mean, 0.6 is, in real world data points, is a reasonably high correlation. And as I just explained, there is an underlying causation to it. So that is how real shadow economy comes into the picture, making housing less affordable in India.
Right. So Shishir, we were talking about the various factors leading to inflation of housing prices. When you spoke about the shadow economy where black money gets parked, we spoke about limited land supply, which again leads to inflation. And another factor which your paper talks about in terms with regard to inflation of prices is the very low FSI, floor space index in Indian cities, cities kind of like Bombay, Bangalore, they've got low single digits FSI, 3.1, 4, maybe 3, things like that. Whereas in comparable global cities like Singapore and New York, you have FSI of 25 and 15 and so on. So what is the meaning of such low FSI in Indian cities? What is this FSI business exactly? How is it decided? And why do we have such low FSI in India?
So Sampath, before I answer this, I just want to qualify that at the opening you said there are supply and demand issues which result in inflation of house prices. I think it is important, as we discussed, that inflation in terms of high house prices, because over time prices have not increased at a supernormal rate, right? For the audience, it is important to realize that when we say inflation, it is the high house price. And not some supernormal increase in house prices over the last three decades, at least, that we have seen. Now, coming back to your question on FSI, right? So first, FSI, what does it mean? FSI is essentially how much area, usable area, either for commercial, office, or residential purposes that you can build, let's say per square feet or per square meter of land, right? So a higher FSI means per square unit of land, you can build more, and conversely for low FSI. And you are absolutely right that for majority of Indian cities, like Bombay, Pune, etc., FSI is actually in low single digits, 1.25, 1.5, 2. And for cities like Singapore, New York, this goes up all the way to 25, 15, and so on, right? So essentially, we are constraining people from utilizing per square unit of land by giving low FSI. And FSI is decided through the master plans. So FSI is decided by the state or the local bodies, and it is a part of the master plan of a city that we discussed. Now the question arises, why do we then keep why does a typical Indian city have low FSI? What is the reason for it? I think the notion is that if you keep FSI low, you are essentially assuming that since not much area is being developed per square unit of land, and hence you will have lesser density of population, and that at least notionally implies that it will put lesser pressure on civic amenities, because if you have higher density, large number of people living in a smaller piece of land, that means they have to be catered to with basic amenities like water, sewage, transport, etc., right? So one of the key reasons why our cities typically go for low FSI is because they want to prevent densification of cities, right? However, in reality, what happens, right, is that people ultimately migrate, right, from the countryside to the urban cities for better living. I should qualify, not necessarily for better living, because living is a multidimensional thing, but for higher incomes, right? And compared to between rural and urban areas, there is average income differential of between 2 to 3 times. So an urban person earns on an average 2 to 3 times that of a rural person, right? So there is this inherent and understandable bias for people living in the countryside to move to cities, right? And that, of course, in a country like India, is a part of our fundamental right. I mean, we can move and settle down wherever we want to within the Indian state, right? Now, if you keep FSI low and people are free to move, they come to cities, and then they end up settling down wherever they find either an open space or in whatever conditions that they can afford, right? So the theoretical notion that low FSI means lesser density and not putting pressure on civic amenities does not translate into reality because of this differential between urban income and rural income, and people coming down to urban cities for higher income opportunities, right? So Mumbai has an FSI of I think 1.3, but the island city is probably one of the densest cities globally, right? Which goes to prove that by keeping FSI low, it does not mean that the pressure on the civic amenities or the density will be low, right? So I'll just stop here.
Right. So this low FSI, how does it impact affordability and so on? Like, is there a direct or indirect link to it? Yeah.
So now, because the plan keeps FSI low, that means the supply of developed land, right, is low, right? Imagine, right, if you had an FSI of 15, let's say, right, you could build, I mean, for simplistic argument, you could build a 15-story housing building. Whereas if FSI is low, you can only build two floors. So there is an order of magnitude in terms of supply release that one can get by a higher FSI. So FSI is one of the key tools to release supply, and a low FSI, other things remaining constant, results in lower developable supply of land, hence pushing up the prices. And it is done, as I just argued, because to prevent congestion and prevent pressure on civic amenities. But in reality, that doesn't turn out to be the case for reasons that I just explained.
Right. And one more factor that sort of adds to the supply side constraints in this context. Now, there are two interesting data points in the paper, Shishir, that I was struck by, and I'm just going to quote it. One, in 2018, the paper says, investment demand for property in India constituted 67% of the total demand for residential real estate in India. And secondly, more than 400,000 units of unsold housing stock exist in India's cities. Now, I was just wondering, I mean, we have a huge mass of people who want houses to stay in. But at the same time, A, you have more than 4 lakh unsold housing stock in India, and B, 67% of the demand for residential real estate, which is there, is for investment and not for usage. Now, I was just wondering, isn't this a huge market failure that in a country with such vast, unfulfilled, end-use demand for housing, the bulk of sectoral activity is oriented away from it? Isn't this like a huge market failure?
Yes, it's a market failure. And it is important to realize that it's a market failure which can be corrected through reforms like releasing land supply in a planned and predictable manner. Right, because you see, market works on economic incentives, right? So why do you see a predominant part of overall demand coming from investment? Because housing, after all, gives decent returns, 9.3 over the last 30 years, right? And when you combine it with folks who have unaccounted income, it becomes a safe haven for them to invest. So long as you have these conditions remaining in terms of scarce supply of land and part of economy which is shadow economy, you will see this kind of a market failure. But the good news, or it is important to realize that it does not require a rocket science for us to change the equilibrium from a high price equilibrium to a more affordable equilibrium. What is required is relatively simple state interventions in terms of credible and granular land use planning and implementation.
Right, I think that was really well, I think, framed. I mean, when you said a shift from a high price equilibrium to a affordable equilibrium, I think that's exactly what India needs right now. People of India need an affordable equilibrium in the housing residential side of real estate market right now. So, one last question before I let
can
you.
I, sorry, yeah. Sampath, sorry. Yeah. Can I just inter? I think, and it is also important to realize that most of states' housing schemes, right, and we discussed this a little earlier, are affordable housing schemes, right? And by definition, they cater to households which are economically weaker, where the market cannot give them or create houses which they can afford. What we are calling for is making housing affordable for the average middle class, and that there is a difference between the two, right? There is no reason why middle class Indians should have to pay 11 times their annual income to buy a house, which is higher than the affordability benchmark of 5. So I just wanted to make a difference, right, between affordable housing schemes, which are usually target for people which the market cannot genuinely serve, versus making housing affordable, which is essentially targeted at middle income, who theoretically speaking should not be devoid of buying a house, given it's a requisite for dignified living.
That's a very good point to make, because this distinction is, I think, important for us to grasp. I mean, on the one hand, you have the government stepping in, saying, okay, the market is not going to address your need for the poor and the lower income groups. So we are going to give you, you know, either we give you directly the houses you want to live in, or we're going to subsidize the price of it. And therefore, you can, you know, make, you can sort of go and get a house for you to stay in. And on the other hand, you have a situation where the market continues exactly the way it is. It continues to remain unaffordable for the middle classes, where, as you said, the PTI is 11 times when it should have been around 5 or closer to 5. So one last question, which is what I was coming to. So what exactly, in terms of concrete measures, the three things which you would like the government to do to make sure that this, the market side of things, where the PTI is 11, it comes down to, say, 6 or 7, where the middle classes can actually look forward to getting a quality, affordable housing within their grasp, within their economic reach? What needs to be done exactly? When you spoke about making it more transparent, digitization of land records and so on, but those are like really long-term things. But immediately, like, what are the one or two things that could happen so that, you know, this PTI becomes more manageable for the middle classes?
So I think, to be honest, I don't know if there is a magic bullet here which can change things overnight. But I would just reiterate, right, that the government should strengthen the implementation of existing reforms like RERA and digitization of land records. Right, these will go a long way. Right, but it needs to be strengthened. Right, I mean, there are some provisions.
What is lacking in RERA right now? I mean, people are. I mean,
so for example,
yeah.
So for example, right, there is a paper that one of my co-authors, Nandini, did with few others, which analyzed RERA and its impact on affordability. And one of the key things that they found that RERA is not standardized across states in the country. So for example, one disclosure that RERA mandates developers to make in Maharashtra is whether the proposed development is on a litigated parcel of land or it is not litigated. Now, this is one key thing, right? I mean, for people to know whether the project that they are considering actually has clear title or not. And I was surprised that this is not, to my mind and my knowledge, this is not a standard feature that is there in all states of India. So I think what is required is RERA is a very good beginning. We need to double down, right, in terms of making it standardized across states, learning from each other, and maybe adding a couple of other dimensions, so that there is more transparency, right, in terms of what people are buying into and what developers are offering. It helps, right, create competition in the market, right? I mean, you drive out the lemons, right, from the peaches, right, through by reducing information asymmetry. Likewise, digitization of land records, right? It has to be done end to end, right? I think right now we have a large part of the maps digitized, but it does not translate into people having full access to the recorded history of that parcel of land, right? It still goes through manual processes, and a lot of diligence is required by people themselves when they decide to buy a piece of real estate, right? So if it is digitized, it just reduces information asymmetry and makes it available seamlessly, right, to people who, again, information is key in this, right? And if you are able to provide information in a seamless manner, that goes a long way in distinguishing peaches and lemons, right? Second is, and we just discussed about this, right, that state has to do its bit in terms of creating master plans which are far more granular, rigorous, and credible. Granular in terms of, right now we have large chunks of land earmarked for A purpose, B purpose, C purpose, compared to Singapore, which has far more granular, right? I mean, so that there is that much more visibility as to what is planned. Rigorous meaning there is no reason for us to have unreal FSI, right? We talked about this, right? We should have reasonable FSI, and then we should have credibility to these plans in terms of requisite funding attached to it. So I think that is one big thing that the state needs to do. And the last thing is, which I realized, right, or we realized little later in the paper, but I think is important, right, that how do we know whether we are on the right track or not? When I say we, it's the state. I think we need the information is sorely lacking in this space. So there is no universally available information on how to calculate affordability, for example. We struggled a lot. I was surprised that house prices themselves are not available over a long period of time. I mean, we relied on a actually anonymized proprietary data from HDFC Bank to be able to do this study. Otherwise, official tracking of house prices started in India from 2010 onwards. And the last thing is competitiveness in the sector, right? We did our analysis, which we discussed, right, that it is not real estate in India is not as competitive. But if the government starts this reform agenda, one of the key things that that I would advise is that they come up with metrics to track performance, because that feeds back into what they need to do subsequently, right? I mean, it is not one short thing, right?
Right.
You do something.
When you say, Shisha, when you say the real estate sector in India is not that competitive, do you mean that a couple of players command super profits, whereas the bulk of the players, the majority of them are like average profitability, but a few, because of whatever privileged access to land or information or whatever it is, they're able to command super premiums from buyers and therefore super profits, and the others are like bunched up together in the average one? Is that what you mean by not competitive
Yeah,
at all?
exactly. That is precisely what it means. And I mean, a little earlier in the discussion, I spoke about how real estate is not as competitive as some of the other industries are, like auto, FMCG, and IT, because there are some developers which have earned on a long-term basis more than 20% profits, which is a very high profitability ratio. And since the key to earning profits in real estate is price at which you are able to sell, and price ultimately is a function of how much land do you have and at the pace you are releasing, right? So it is all it, in a way it is linked, right? It is the ability of these developers to hold on to good parcels of land, releasing it in small parcels, because they know that overall supply is not coming, is not increasing at a fast pace, which gives them supernormal profits. Again, I just want to emphasize, this is rational behavior on part of these developers, whoever they are, right? If I was them, I would also do that, right? It is rational on my part to maximize profits. So markets function on economic incentives, right? But it is, and hence it is the duty of the state to set economic incentives in a manner which fosters competition.
Right. On that note, I think, Shishir, we'll have to wind up now. I mean, you have sort of beautifully joined the dots with regard to, transparency, competitiveness, and very important point you made about information asymmetry. I think whenever a person goes into the real estate market to buy a property, I think they come face to face with this information asymmetry. I mean, the broker or the developer knows far more about what exactly is going on in a particular parcel of land or geography than the person who is going there to buy. I think even this point about digitization of land records, I think when information is at one's fingertips or mouse click, so to speak, it's much more easier to know exactly the status and the value of each offer being made to the customer or the buyer. And when there is information asymmetry, I think the ability of a particular player who, as you said, some of them could command 20% profit margins and so on. That comes down and everything becomes more competitive. I think all these factors are important in making the entire sector more affordable for the buyer. And I think the state, as you rightly said, has a role to play in setting the incentives right for the industry so that there is all more overall a more rational framework for every player in this domain. Thank you so much, Shishir, for joining us, for sharing your insights from your own experience and from the paper you and your co-authors have put together. Pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much, Sampath, for having me.
In Focus will be back soon with analysis of the biggest news issues. In the meantime, you can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other platforms. Just search for In Focus by The Hindu. We'll see you soon.